The Press Box is here to catch you up on the latest media stories. Hosted by Brian Curtis and David Shoemaker, these guys have the insight on the biggest stories you care about. Check out The Press Box on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down in your local, wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello, and welcome to a special episode of the Watch Podcast. My name is Chris Ryan. I'm an editor at TheRinger.com, and I'm joined as always by Andy Greenwald. Andy, say hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. Andy and I are recording this on Monday morning in the West Coast time zone. That is not a time zone. It's the Pacific Standard Time Zone. It doesn't matter. Last night, we recorded and released our Succession recap podcast, reacting to the season 3 finale, the episode 9. And today we talked with that show's creator and repeat watch guest, Jesse Armstrong. Andy, I thought we could maybe chat a little bit about any late breaking takes or thoughts we've had on the Succession finale before we get into our conversation with Jesse.
Just the number one, because you know we love to talk about the talking about, I have been really pleasantly surprised to, in my own small corner of the metaverse, see that the response to the finale has been, it appears to be uniformly positive. And that gladdens my heart. You know, I think there was maybe a tone of, I don't know, anticipatory defensiveness last night, because I thought that the episode was just psychologically and emotionally brilliant and brilliant storytelling and totally gratifying for the show that I've been a fan of and we've been a fan of and much of America has been a fan of for a while now. But I think I was worried that, you know, there weren't dragons. Like there wasn't a major death, and that maybe the discourse had hardened people into expecting that and potentially feeling cheated without it. And that does not seem to be the case, you know, and that's a testament to the finale that Jesse Armstrong and his crew pulled off. But also, you know, people, I think people like what the show delivers. You know, I think they are all in on the product, especially in season finales. And that's been really, that's been nice to see.
Yeah, you know, in the heat of the moment, I think that the fever dream of the week leading up to the finale almost took over my attention span from the actual product that I was watching on Sunday night. So, you know, very quickly into, and we're obviously spoiling what happens in the finale, so please don't listen to a bonus episode about the finale of the season if you haven't watched it. But in those opening seconds, as it's the questions about Kendall's safety are kind of answered, you know, I kind of unpacked a lot of that. And then almost with all the running around the wedding and as things get more and more intense, you know, I almost want to go back and watch the finale knowing what happens at the very end to rewatch the Tom scenes. And even from the last couple of episodes, thinking about where Tom is and that kind of strangeness to a lot of his interactions with people over the course of the season. Obviously, a lot of people have pointed out that he essentially tells Logan or tells Kendall, you know, Kendall, you always get fucked and I've never seen Logan get fucked once. You know, like that kind of stuff that's there. And we asked Jesse about that sort of, that kind of scaffolding that you put on a plot development. I thought it was fascinating, but for as much as I adore Succession as a week to week, one episode at a time experience, it changes a little bit when you think about it as a whole, you know?
Yeah. And one thing we didn't really get into last night is that part of my experience watching the finale last night was I felt a little high in the beginning, honestly, in the first 10 minutes, because what was happening as the characters were saying, yes, Kendall almost died, but he was rescued and he's going to be as fine as he has been. And this is how we're processing it. And this is what we're feeling about it. And this is the level of our concern versus the other quotidian things that are taking up our day, like, you know, whether Carrie could bring Roman a club sandwich. It was the feeling that you get with things that's really unique to television when you're invested in something. And so much of your investment is anticipatory investment. This could be anything. And I'm so excited. And then you feel the pen touching the paper. And it's like, it's never going to be anything other than this. They are talking about the thing we were speculating. Yeah. And you know what? I like what they're doing. I like that they're saying it. They're not dancing. They're just telling the story they were always intending to tell. And, you know, I don't think this will come as a surprise to anyone, but that when Jesse speaks about that, I mean, you know, he is driven, his true north is these characters that he mm-hmm. clearly loves. And as you'll also hear, speaks about almost as if they're living people. And this is the path that made sense for them. And he's the decider on that. And it's not as if it was all still in flux over the last week, but he was never going to be wavered. And that's what we actually want, all of us, not just podcasters, I think, in a television show that we commit so much time and headspace to.
So without further ado, we can get into our conversation with Jesse Armstrong, the creator of Succession. That'll be coming up right now. And then Andy and I will have our normal show on Thursday. So thanks to everybody for listening to our Succession stuff. And we can't wait for everybody to hear from Jesse here.
I just want people to know, I think all our shows are special.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. When we're just like, let's read the trades. Those are the best ones.
You're right. Okay. This is a little more special. It was awesome that we got a chance to talk to Jesse after this fantastic season.
Here we go.
So over the past week, Succession fans, or at least the extremely online version of the fans, seem to go totally berserk with the speculation over Kendall's fate and the intention of the last image of him floating in the pool. And one thing that kept me, and I think some others, from tipping off our own metaphorical floaty was a feeling that the version of the show where Kendall dies, it doesn't really track with the more deliberative, messy, and emotional show that you've been crafting for the previous 28 episodes. For me, case in point last night was when Kendall delivers the sort of the ultimate prestige television line of, I'm not a good person. And Roman says, you're fine. Can you talk a little bit about your reaction to the wild speculation, if it reached you, as well as what this sort of story that you've been crafting, one that's dramatic and surprising without being shocking, all caps, why that's important to you as the showrunner and storyteller?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I keep a bit of a distance from the staff, from the world. It's this weird paradox, right, where we do the show and I do the show because I love it and I think I want it to be in the cultural conversation of the world. And then when it is, there's a bit of me that would like to do nothing more than just read stuff about people reacting to the show because that's exactly what I want. And yet, you know, if it gets too much in your head, you know what the world is like. It's nuts and every individual person is fine, but as a agglomeration, it's too much and you start feeling like the world's asking, you know, for madder music, stronger wine, and you'll tip over the edge. So yeah. So I keep a bit of a distance from that. On the other hand, I'm not a monk, so I was aware of like this vibrations of like of what's happened to Kendall, which is, you know, fine, because we laid that in there, I think, you know, not in a trashy way. Hopefully that's anyone who's watched this show will have seen that he's not been going in a very good trajectory. So, you know, like within the world of like the, if Succession was real, which is what I try and spend all my time trying to persuade you it is, which is why I find it sometimes hard coming on podcasts, because I have to acknowledge it's not. In the world where Succession is real, he could have died. Like that's the place he was in. He was not looking after himself. His kids had gone away. Who knows where the nanny was? His PR's not around at that moment. He's not looking after himself. Who know? I don't like putting sometimes too hard a point on things if I want to let me and Jeremy and my fellow writers decide what we think in private, but he certainly wasn't looking after himself. Did he intend to something awful to happen, to end his life, or was he just really careless? I don't know, but that possibility was there. But, you know, from the early on in the crafting of the season, we knew that wouldn't be what happened. There was never an episode where he did die, but it had to be alive in a world. So I've now come to the end of what I think about that. But have I answered the question?
I guess it's just the other piece of it is just the type of story that kind of enlivens you and you're passionate about, and why that might not be what some bloodthirsty fans were, they might not be aligned with that wholly in a way, you know. And I think that one of the geniuses of the show is that you've stayed true to how the catastrophic thing doesn't always happen. And in fact, when the catastrophe doesn't happen, the detritus and mess that you're left behind with is often more dramatically compelling, if messy and difficult to convey.
Yeah, I guess I just wouldn't dismiss the bloodthirsty. The bloodthirsty have a point, like maybe it could have happened. It could have happened. And I hope we'd have the courage, if we felt that was the thing that should happen, that we would follow through on it and go, oh, fuck, what, is our show going to be broken? Because I'm not sure this table stands up with only, you know, two legs. Sorry, Connor, three legs. So I hope we'd have the courage to do it. Were we to do it, is that the way in which, you know, aesthetically we would do it? I kind of don't know because we didn't. But it's not impossible. And as you know, we had a death and a crash and quite a dramatic incident that happened in the first season. And we did that because it feels like those things sometimes happen to people. And I don't want to exclude anything in the world from the show, but they don't happen often. So you have to be mindful of that. They certainly shouldn't happen every week, or then the show would be a different show.
So this is the part of the pod where I stand up on my desk like I'm in Dead Poets Society and say, it's me, I'm bloodthirsty, because I actually thought...
Well, I'm here to say it's okay. It's
yeah,
okay.
I mean, I wasn't
great,
that I was...
Everybody.
It wasn't that I wanted a who well. Shot JR moment, but I did think that, first of all, to paraphrase Logan, he would be floating in some dead, you know, some French guy's pool. Like, it would have been almost the completion of a prophecy. But even more so, the corner he was written into, but the trajectory, it was almost like he was at the end of a quest. He had failed the quest. He had had this final conversation with Logan, realized he would never be able to escape him, you know, and found and almost just disappears. You know, he almost is the drowning man. And I wondered whether or not you've thoroughly
let's
answered this question.
Let's go back and reshoot it.
Oh, great. We can cancel this podcast.
Has it gone out?
It's not. No. We just had the screener, so
realized I made the most terrible mistake.
I guess my question was whether or not you entered the writing of 8 with, or even toyed with it as a distinct possibility. But you've answered that question thoroughly here.
Yeah. No. It was up. You know, the show is flexible on the day. Is flexible in the blocking, but it's pretty inflexible in terms of, like, after the first couple of weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks of the room, I get a shape that I'm happy with of where the show is going, and that shape maybe it could change 1 year, but that we've never gone, hey, you know what, fuck, we should do a really big plot move like that would have been as the seasons developed. I was very happy with this where we were going. And so that's where we were always going.
And I imagine in a case like that, that allows you to sort of lay the tracks for something like what happens with Tom in the final scene over the course of the entire season, because you have that shape and you're able to sprinkle in things like the Nero conversation with Tom and Greg, or just every reaction shot of him listening to Shiv sort of isolate him and humiliate him more. Was that something that you arrived at early, that this was going to sort of end with the Tom father scene of him closing Kay out of the room?
Yeah. Yeah. That we knew that's where we're heading for sure. But it has to be a spiral, like, right. We can't be like, Tom's going to turn into Spider-Man. Like, how do we get there? Right. It has to feel like, oh shit, he could get there. Does it feel true along every step? Would we want to go on that journey? And is that where we're going? So I would never be like, okay, we want I keep on thinking of stupid examples, Kendall, to become a major league baseball player, if that's correct phrase.
Yes, it is.
How can we get there? That's tough, right? But is it latent that Tom could, given his relationship to power and his feelings, could he get there? Yeah, I think he could. So is it interesting to follow him? Yeah, it is. So it has to be both things have to be happening at once. We have to have a destination we really believe in, and then we follow the steps, which also have to be fun and keep on reinforcing themselves.
We on the podcast and as fans talk often about how your writing and the writing of your staff in the show is just next level. It's absolutely phenomenal, and we take such pleasure in watching it. And the feeling that is conveyed through the screen is how much fun you all have crafting it and writing it. But rather than just praise you for the remainder of our time, I wanted to specifically ask about the pleasures that you and the writers have in writing specifically for the amazing performers that you have. And, you know, whether it's knowing that Matthew McFadden can go from Peter Parker to the Avenging Spider-Man in your metaphor, or specifically keeping it grounded in the finale last night, the incredible sibling scene in the Italian dust. What was so incredibly pleasurable about that, in addition to the emotional weight of the scene, was that we got to see play out in front of us some of the distinctions and contrasts that were in the news in the New Yorker profile, for example, where, you know, Kieran says that he always thought it was a comedy, and Jeremy Strong says, I think it's Hamlet. And then you have a scene where the two of them, one is performing a comedy because he can't stand to be forced into a production of Hamlet. And it is both, you know, enjoyable on its own as the text, but it's also, there's the meta piece of it too, where we're enjoying watching these two disparate performers come together to play something surprising.
Good. I feel like there's a lot of questions in there.
There are.
My favorite bit was when you were saying how good we were, and in particular me. So
I did watch the light leave your eyes.
Any
Once
thoughts?
I said that, yeah. I noticed you just check out and bask, which is fine.
I love it. I love the writing for these people, and I love the texture of it. You know, I come out of sitcom. That was my training ground and sort of first love. And every syllable has to count in drama, but maybe sitcom is a good place as a training ground for that, because in a good sitcom, there is no fucking around. Everything has to be working. And I hope that I believe we keep that discipline in this, whatever you want to call it, the drama hour, with some jokes in and some comic beats, because I think those happen in life. And certainly, as you point out, some people, that's the way some people either get to the truth or defend themselves against the truth. So yeah, I love writing for these people. All those tones are in life, and Jeremy in his approach, I guess, I think Freud said that there's no such thing as a joke. And I think that's in a way that's maybe what Jeremy would say, but I think that, you know, in a way there's no such thing as only a joke, right? Or they all, almost all jokes, I think almost all jokes have some meaning coded into them, and you can lean into that or you can lean away from it, and you could analyze it or you can not. So Jeremy can do comedy. Jeremy knows exactly what he's doing the whole time. And sometimes the comedy that he does, it comes out of the complete and utter engagement. You know, that rap he did in the last season, it can only live with his total belief that this is a good idea and that he's kind of cool doing it, which he kind of almost, for me, gets away with because his engagement with it is, and that's why it's also so sort of somewhat unwatchable. So I've gone down a rabbit hole of why Jeremy's good, but what else can I say about the writing?
I believe you were.
Do you want to return to how good I am? Because that seemed like a rich vein to me.
We have a couple of those at the end. They're major league softballs. But I think it's funny you mentioned Freud, because I believe Shiv was quoting Freud when she was telling Roman that he could only get an erection at his mother's marriage. Right. Like, I think that, I believe maybe it's Maybe it's paraphrasing, but that was in...
Yeah, well, I think I only know it in the original German, so that's probably where I've gone around.
You know, I had one question, but I wanted to ask a follow-up to Andy's bit there, and that scene that they're shooting outside with Jeremy sitting in the gravel, and a lot of people have been marveling at the sort of the framing of that whole confrontation between the three siblings and Kendall kind of finally breaking down. It struck me that, you know, we've had some cathartic moments from Kendall in the past couple of seasons, but it was the first time that I had seen him do that in front of Roman, in front of Kiernan. And I was wondering if you have any recollections from that day of shooting and what it was like, because I think that, you know, as TV shows do, you do a lot of separation to reunite, and those siblings had not had a very quiet moment with each other since the moment in the third season when they decide they're not going to sign up with Kendall's plan. Can you tell us a little bit about the shooting of that scene?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I want you to believe it's real. But I'm going to have to abandon that because it's obviously not. I don't know why I want, you know, I've been watching Landscapers, British show, and
yeah, sure,
Theme from a Marriage, both of which do a good job of, like, they both do the same thing of going, hey, you know, this isn't real. And then 2 minutes in, because of the quality of all those actors, you're like, I think this is real. So I don't know why I'm so eager to make you think it's real. But so I will take you behind the scenes. It was super hot day. It was a long day. It was dusty, as you saw. That was not wind machines. That was the Tuscan wind blowing through. It's a long ass scene. It's gritty, literally gritty bits of stuff going in people's eyes. It's hot for the camera operators, who are geniuses and dance with the cast in an amazing way. And we're sort of sitting on old farm machinery, probably getting tetanus from rusty nails going in us. And I was scared because I found the whole episode challenging to get right. I was anxious about us landing this episode, and that without that scene, that's kind of fulcrum of the re-engagement of them working. It didn't feel like the ending would work, and if the ending of the episode didn't work, the season kind of doesn't work. So it was tough, and as you say, you know, there's a lot of physical and emotional geometry going on to get them into those relationships. And I thought I had written the list of things they had to say to get there, but we know we'd had a couple of read throughs. But until you're watching it happen, you don't know whether it's going to work. And I feel self-aggrandizing going on about it to such a degree, but it was really important, and it felt hard, and we didn't get it initially. And it was about a bunch of things about how, where everyone was, and how, you know, to elicit sympathy, there had to be openness, and then to show the openness, there had to be a degree of availability for that. It was just tough to achieve for the actors, and then when they got it, it was, I think the technical term is, fucking great.
I wonder about
me. Could you
say that in German? I think it would sound a little more melodious on the ears. I did want to ask in that scene about the touching of the heads. I loved it so much. It did, on one hand, I was like, oh, this is like a painting. But on another hand, this is like what people wearing human suits think humans do. You know, like they can't actually embrace. So it's like, I'll touch the part where your thinking brain is. You know, I don't know if that just came from the actors or if you specifically.
That's genius. Yeah, I don't think there was anything about head touching. There's a little bit of blocking in the script. There's only suggestions. That's all them finding it. And that's, I guess, what I'm talking about. And, you know, who knows why the hell something feels real and why it doesn't at the end of the day. And that's just down to casting three genii in those roles, and they do it. So, and it's wonderful when they do.
I wanted to ask, specifically, like, as people listening and in our own experience in speaking to you, Jesse, you're a lovely person. We enjoy speaking to you so much, especially when we compliment you. But there must be some steel in your spine in a Logan Roy-esque way, because as we were marveling throughout the season, there must come during a long season, the day that the shooting schedule and the cast list come out for the episodes in the beautiful Tuscan countryside and some names aren't on it. And I was wondering how that how those conversations go. Like, is Fisher Stevens upset?
I don't know. I hope not.
Who got to go and who didn't get to go?
Yeah, I guess it is. I'm pretty kind of stupid about it. I managed to not think about that. I think it's like casting, you know, you see if when I watch cast, you know, you're doing a new role. If it's a role where people are reading for it, you can eat. If I imagined every person getting up, having breakfast, thinking maybe they like the show, maybe they've never heard of it, but maybe they like it and they think that would be cool, and coming in and excited and reading, I just couldn't stand it. It's, you know, I know actors and it's tough and it's just heartbreaking to think of what you do when you learn the role, but I can't, right? I can't do that about every person. I have to choose. And you have to exclude all that stuff and become hardened to that particular thing. And similarly with the show, I would love to write a movie. They might not be very good movies, but I could try and write a movie for every person in this extended cast. And I would love it, but I can't do that. And I can't think about those parts of the feelings, and so about who goes where and how much screen time you have and what story. The only consoling thing is that I never do, I never have, and I never will. I will only ever think about the show, and I'll never think about who I want to hang out with or what would be a cool bit that someone on Twitter might like, or what, you know, feeling bad about X or Y. We just have to follow the logic of what would happen to this big company. What are these people like? What are they going to do? What's an interesting, true thing and funny thing to show people about that? And then that's who's in the scene. And then as long as everyone understands that, it's kind of become simple because it's not about anything apart from that. And so it might be a bit sad, but you know what? We're hopefully making a good show that will be around for a while. So that's fine.
And Frank and Carl got to go in the end anyway.
Yeah.
So it was okay. We were happy.
Hugo got to go to Bosnia, right? So, I mean, who's complaining?
That's right.
One of the things I wanted to ask about the Tom scene is that when you look at it within the context of moments that built up to it, and even some lines throughout the show that didn't have anything to do with Tom, you can kind of assemble a sort of a succession's laws of the jungle. And obviously in this example, like Logan would sort of be the king, but this idea that Logan values someone being a killer over everything else, that is essentially what he is sort of looking for. If he is indeed looking for anyone, that is something he values. And in your mind, do you think that in a metaphorical way, Tom became a killer in this last episode?
Did he become a killer? I guess he betrayed his wife to get some advantage. If you want to call that a killer, then he did. You know, I've got a keen appreciation, I think, that people say a lot of things, and the terrible thing is that sometimes what they say is true and sometimes it's not, and it's hard to distinguish between those two.
Yeah.
Those two. Sometimes even for the person saying them. So I'm not uninterested in rules. They exist in life. Some people have rules and breaking points. But sometimes you might say, I want a killer, but it doesn't mean it's true. So I guess I'm always amenable to thinking there might be another truth under the truth. And I think, I don't know why people respond to the show, but if they do, I think, you know, there's a yes, but quality and also quality, a thing about the contingency of life, the variousness of life, the complexity, the perverseness of human nature, that people respond to and that I always want to keep alive, because that seems true to me, that people are constantly surprising you, enraging you, disappointing you, delighting you in ways that you didn't see coming. But then once you see them, you're like, of course. So yeah, it's, I wouldn't say it's he's just become a killer and that's what Logan wants, but he might have become a killer and maybe that's a bit of what Logan wants.
Yeah, I mean, I get it's really fascinating to talk to you because I feel this tension between allowing these characters to almost exist as real people, as like you're saying. And then I think I have a tendency somewhat to ascribe literary notions to the characters, whether it's because I was fascinated by the moment where Kendall is sort of almost unburdening himself of being a killer, of saying like, by admitting this, maybe I can cleanse myself and get free of it finally. Is it's almost like Tom's like, I'll take that. I will take that on and destroy your sister and you know, orchestrate this whole thing. But that is actually one of the reasons why the show is such an object of deep fascination for me, because they can actually, those things can happen at the same time. As a writer, I'm sure you have to have, you almost have to have that unconditional belief that they are real though, right?
A little bit. You know, I like both things. In a way, that's what the whole process of running the writer's room and making the show is like keeping it open, closing it down, keeping it open, closing it down. And anything could happen, but only this can happen. But within that, they could say anything, but they could only say this. So I think that is that we're sort of hitting the same point there. And yeah, I don't want to bullshit anyone that we're not trying to make a really good TV show, and there are certain restrictions and prescriptions that we don't sometimes think, hey, that would make a cool piece of TV. That, you know, that would be phony. I've got very strong sense of what I think makes a good hour of TV, but I hope that we honor the aim of following emotional and business and kind of material truth. You know, a lot of the show breaks down to like, if you've got that job, that's what you do. Yeah. And that's a pretty reductive, remorseless logic, and it's kind of a machine to try and escape from. And that can fit that also applies to one's role within a family. So yeah.
Something you said a moment ago really sparked something in me, which is the idea of there being another
first
truth behind
thing
the truth. Yeah, well, I've had you muted, honestly. I'm sorry. I'm so used to just sharing my opinions on this podcast.
He's reading Twitter. Yeah.
When's he gonna stop? Because I've figured this fucking show out. I know what it is.
This is a little challenging, you know, and you've been, I assume, so thoughtful in your answers. I notice sometimes you look away and I've unmuted excitedly thinking it was my chance, but so far, I think we've figured it out. But specifically, this idea of the truth behind the truth. When I've been uncorking my personal monologues about your show over the last few weeks, there's a metaphor that I struggle with. But basically, I'm always in awe that there is, as you're doing this emotional surgery on these characters you've created, I feel like by now you must have hit bone. And yet, there's always a little bit more muscle. There's always another layer. There's always a truth behind the truth. And often when I'm talking about that, I'm thinking about Tom and Shiv, which, you know, from a layman's perspective, I'm like, well, they've bottomed out. There's nowhere else for them to go emotionally after this terrible truth about the, you know, the different type of sadness Tom might feel. Well, there's nowhere to go from there. Or there's nowhere more to go with him realizing that she wouldn't mind him going to prison. There's nowhere to go beyond this, I love you, but I don't love you. And yet there's always a little more. And I wonder about specifically in terms of your process that keeps you focused on this particular surgery, that there might be more, that it's rewarding to continue to mine the same vein and not, you know, earmuffs to the bloodthirsty Chris, but just break them up, you know, or we're done.
Yeah, good. It's a good question. I think it's something you learn. I think you learn as like a sitcom writer, like, don't save that joke, just fucking go for it. You know, there's always going to be another idea. It can feel like there isn't, but there will be. And if there is, and maybe one day it will run out, but guess what? Then the show's over and, you know, you did it. So I think you're right. And there is whenever I feel the tendency of like, let's save that. Some things you have to save. You have to save them because you're not there yet. But, I don't think we ever save it because we might do 8 seasons and we don't want to burn that yet. It's like, burn it. If that's the thing to say, say it. Because I think it's a human impulse as well as a creative impulse of like, oh, fuck, what happens after I say it? And guess what? You're still there. You know, it's the thing of like, I can't go on, I must. There, it could get pretty, it might get bleak or it might get pretty great, but there is always something beyond the thing. And, you know, this show won't go on forever. So I'm not scared of, or, and I don't want it to. And I, you know, it's, I'm not that, the kind, I don't, that doesn't bother me when we get to the end, we get to the end, and that's great. In some ways, yeah, that will be great. So I have no concern that the tub of, you know, of zesty story is going to run out, because if it does, well, or when it does, and you know, it, that's good. And I'm always struck as well. There's a thing that always amuses and depresses me. Like, you've probably read these, like, celebrity interviews when people have had a hard time and they do a piece about a marriage or a thing or a tragedy. And often the narrative is, I was in this bad place and now it's over.
Right.
Now it's going to be great because I bought this house or this new relationship or have
started a foundation.
Adopted these kids.
And then, you know, a year later, you read the next piece and it's like, that was when I was at my lowest, and that those those moments of catharsis and breakthrough are often bit things you tell yourself for, you know, that this is your, this is your lowest point or this is your highest point, can both be fictions that you tell yourself to keep going. And I'm interested in what lies beyond. Not that there's always is something fascinating beyond, but there often is.
I love that you mentioned the history you had with sitcoms, because I think that one of the unique things about the show is that when complaints do bubble up, and we'll shield you from them for the most part. But
thank you. I'm very papery, huge ego, but papery.
Of course. Oh, I don't think there's ever been a show in which both of these two complaints have been lodged at it. One is, well, they're circling the same thing. These same things keep happening. Where's the forward momentum? And then at the end of the season, people say, well, he's written himself into a corner this time. This is too dramatic a change. Right. Nothing can change. And it really speaks to the TV audience's desire for everything new all the time, but please keep my friends together. You know, that is the central tension. But it's very interesting to me that you have that sitcom background and you're captaining a ship that is going, kind of attempting to navigate in both directions at once.
Yeah. And I hope we can do it. I hope we do it okay. I think there is a certain tension there, which is, I know, you know, from sitcom, like, you, I don't love change in my core, in the core group, in a show, in a technical way. This show's a drama. Things have to change. Circumstances must change. They do change. It's about it's about a dynamic that's there from the name of the show. And that I don't want to artificially delay that, nor do I want to artificially accelerate it. I want to show a process happening. I want to see what that feels like. I want to explore every bit of that, and then it'll be done. I think there is a tension there. There is a tension there. I think it's a legitimate concern about, and we talk about it in the room, and yeah, we have to just try and stick to the truth of what's happening to these people and what's happening in the world.
Glad you said what's happening in the world, because my favorite, I think one of my favorite episode this season was What It Takes, was the sort of CPAC-esque kind of selection of the next Republican candidate. And part of the reason why I was so fascinated by it was because, for the most part, Succession is concerned with the politics of the people in the room. So it's like, sort of, what is transpiring? What are the power dynamics between the people in any given room or on the end of another phone call? But this was one of the first times where, you know, you obliquely refer to the raisin, and there is a reference to a world outside of these rooms. But this was the sort of real look we got at these guys. And I was curious about, when you're writing something that is like this world, or but not of this world that we live in, What kind of conversations do you have with yourself and with your writers about what you want these characters, the presidential candidates, but also the sort of dynamics happening, to represent, so that it feels like this is something that might happen, but it's not necessarily the thing that is happening in our viewers and our audience's lives?
Yeah, that's just a tightrope. It's a tightrope to which, and there are definite answers, yes and no's, yes, right, this, but not that. but there isn't a rule book for that. And it's, you know, how far back does history go? You know, who can we mention? Reagan? Yeah, sure. Clinton? Yeah, I think so. But does it, then do you start, questions start bouncing around? So and then you make up a bunch of rules, and then you, the right line comes in and you break them all and it just feels right. So that's quite instinctive. It has to be a reflection of the world, but if it's too close to it, it becomes a Romanaclet or a sort of satire of the kind I wouldn't want to write, that's too direct or too pointed. But if it becomes too general, it's blunt and useless. So it's a lot, you know, like the media landscape stuff and the family stuff, it's a ton of reading. It's like putting it all into the mixer and hoping that we can get it out in a shape which is both feels true but has a, you know, archetypal rather than stereotypical, I guess is what is the sort of sweet spot you're heading for.
Yeah.
I think we have time for one more question. So I think it makes sense to steer back to the final moments of the finale. And one of the things that was so striking and honestly breathtaking about it was after spending so much time, especially this season, with from the kids' point of view, that Shiv and Roman and Kendall have differing opinions about how to conduct themselves or how to take over the business, but that this was a plausible outcome, that one of them would win, one of them would succeed in it. To have this final episode where the rug, a very expensive, intricate rug, I'm sure, is pulled out from under them and they are completely panicking. They know nothing of what's going on. And when they burst into the room, the grown-ups are there. And, you know, I mentioned jokingly Frank and Carl being there, but it was brilliant that they were there, even just for their heavy presence in the room, because the adults had taken over and they were going to do what they were always going to do, which was right for the business. And the kids are exposed in a way as kids, in a way that I feel like we haven't seen them behave before or react before. What excites you about that place that you've left us in with them? What stories ahead of you now, obviously without tipping any of them, intrigues you and the writers and gets you? I mean, if you want to tip them, that's great. We love breaking news, but I wanted to give you the out. In terms of where you left us, what are you most excited about picking up on?
Well, yeah, I might get close to the sort of questions I'm not good on and that feels like, oh, I'm like, anyway, what can I say about that that's useful and true? I'm not afraid of kind of in some ways writing ourselves into a corner because I'm not too, I feel like we can go wherever the show is capable, not forever, but for enough to follow these people. We're sufficiently interested in them and their stories will be true. So I do have a pitch of what the next season will be. I have a pitch of what the end of the show will be. But I don't know exactly. I don't know right now, or I have a pitch, but I whether it'll survive contact with their enemy or AKA my colleagues, I don't know. But you know, I guess what I liked about the Mattson and Gojo buying out Logan is it just felt like, fuck, that wouldn't happen. You know, there's the, to go literary political, I think it's Trotsky who was like, revolution is impossible until it's inevitable. And that's what that's, you know, I love that feeling in art. And I love that feeling about the business dealings of like, yeah, Logan would never do that. Never until like, yeah, that's what he would do. And so I'm excited by the truth of that and seeing what's on the other side of it.
We won't hold you to your answer and you can pretend that the connection was lost and we won't hold it against you. But last night when we were recording an instant reaction podcast, Chris asked me this question and I figured since we have you for one more minute, we could ask you.
Well, I've got a little bit of time, so hit me, but go ahead.
Sure. Well, then you could just answer this one at great length in English and German, whatever you're comfortable with. He asked me what's more interesting for the season premiere of season 4, 5 minutes after this scene happens or 5 months? Mm. And, you know, you're at that moment where, as you said before, anything is possible, except it isn't. It's going to be one thing. And I wonder if you had either a specific answer to that or, without stepping on your intention, how you feel about the open road ahead of you.
Yeah, I would take the fifth on that. I know what I would answer right now, but it feels like it'd be dumb to say for whatever reason. So yeah, I mean, and the road ahead, yeah, I felt very intimidated, honestly. I felt very intimidated by the last season of the the last episode of the previous season, which I wrote, and I felt like I thought it was good, and I was worried that I wouldn't be able to write an episode that would be as good again. And you've been warm about it, and some people who I trust have been warm about this one. So I'm scared about whether we can do it all again. But also, the nice thing is that that feeling, like 3 minutes after when we reassemble for the writer's room, it goes, and we'll be thinking about a joke or a bit or a scene. And that's the only way you can do it, right? The mountain is I'm going a little bit spiritual towards the end, but yeah, you know, the mountain's sort of unclimbable, but you just have, you know, the first step is doable, right? So you just have to, and luckily it's also really, really good fun. That's like, that is the, I think my favorite part of doing the show is the time in the room and talking about all the possibilities. And so that is what takes the icy grip off your intestines.
But you really have been watching Iger Sanction, haven't you? This is a joke last night. I was just like, he's got mountains on the brain. Jesse, thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you so much for making this show. It's an object of endless fascination for Andy and I, and it's, you know, obviously something that we adore. So it's fantastic to hear about the process of making it and everything else.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, your questions are smart, and it's, you know, if I can find, I have a hard time. I kind of love talking about the show, but I sometimes find it hard to find the things that say that are both true, interesting, and kind of worth saying. So I hope I've had a few of those. And yeah, thanks for, you know, they're smart questions, and also you're very nice about it. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. A pleasure.